Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Mark Borkowski, PR industry legend. He began his career as a theatre publicist at 19 and soon became known as the go-to expert for publicity stunts. He started his own firm in 1987, working with consumer brands and celebrities including Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page, Eddie Izzard, Live Nation, Nissan, Cadbury and Sony. Mark is a regular TV and radio pundit on the media, celebrity and the art of publicity and has written two books. Mark, thank you for joining me.
Greetings, Paul.
How are you doing?
I felt a bit strange, actually. I mean, you know, you've been... How long have you been asking me to do this?
Oh, I've been banging on at you for years to get you in that chair.
Well, I thought, well... If
you're
you
a legend.
If you can nail Linton Crosby, I thought, well, I better consider it. But it's weird for me because, you know, you did mention very kindly that in that intro that I do like to comment on other people. I don't actually like talking about myself.
Well, this is going to be an hour of hell for
you,
then,
well,
frankly.
It's going to be odd. I must admit, it's going to be odd. You know, it doesn't come easy to me talking about me.
Well, let's talk about your work for a bit, because, I mean, you've been doing this 40 years. You're one of my heroes. I've been doing PR for 15 years, and I've got about a tenth the talent and the experience of you. Can you just tell me what the secret is?
I've never worked a day in my life, and I have a passion for people. I've always had a passion for people's stories, people's adventures. And I've commercialised that, I guess. I was incredibly lucky and fortunate. I think I would get, I don't know, 10, 12 emails a day from people wanting to get into PR. You know, people who hear me and speak to me and say, how do my kids, you know, get into PR? And I lucked out. I think that I had a guiding spirit. My father died when I should have been working hard at getting into my university. I always wanted to be a history teacher. I'm obsessed by history. And then I thought maybe I should go to art college. And then I thought maybe I should be a town and country planner. Exactly.
Jesus.
How bizarre is that? And that's how confused, you know, a kid is doing that.
Milton Keynes would have looked very different if you'd have been on the town planning committee.
And then I found myself, my father died, which has had a deeply profound effect on me. It was right in the middle of the sort of, you know, the punk explosion. I was fascinated by the Pistols, and I became incredibly fascinated by Malcolm McLaren. And I actually realised I couldn't sing, couldn't play his instrument, but actually I loved the Sphinx. I could see what was happening. I had an instinct. I read the NME when it was the sort of thing to read every week. And in fact, there's a front cover blown up on my office wall of the Grundy, you know, sort of four-letter expletive moment on Thames, which made them. And I thought, this is generating such a conversation about them. And I wanted to be that person. You know, university came bumping down to the ground because I'd spent too much time. I look at my own kids now and how hard they've worked for their exams and get through university. I never was into that, and I came from a different time. And it was Thatcher. It was all the explosion going on there. And I just thought, you know, I woke up one day and what the hell am I going to do? You know, I was sort of, you know, failed miserably getting into the various places I had at you know, university. And I thought, what am I going to do? I need to grow up. You know, my father's death was quite a weight. And I did some sort of no-hoping sort of jobs. I ended up working in a pork pie factory at sort of 17, 18, I forget how old it was.
What were you doing?
Selling pork pies.
Oh, you were selling them. You weren't like putting
pies,
the jelly.
Gala pies, right. The whole thing. I wasn't making them, but I got this job marketing them. And I was pretty good at selling pork pies, you know. You know, I loathed it. I hated every moment of it. I went to work every day and drove to this is now long deceased, this sort of family place down in Gloucestershire, Hilliers. I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. And all my mates were in university, I was sort of doing this job, getting paid quite well, I might add. But that's when I realised that money isn't your compass.
Yeah. It was more compensation, wasn't it, for the horrendous days?
And God bless my mother. In the days when local newspapers advertised jobs, do you remember that? There was a job that my mother spotted for a trainee marketing and a general sort of management executive at a theatre in Swindon. And I thought, my mum said, you've got to go for it. And I got an interview. remarkably. I mean, I wasn't qualified. And this is the other thing. There are things that happen in your life. There are moments that happen in your life that are stellar moments that actually change your course of life. And some of them you bring on yourself and intentionally, some things outside forces drive you. And I remember I was sort of driving and I got to the top of the road. And I thought, I'm never going to get a job. I'm not going to go to bloody Swindon. I'm going to get a job in theatre. I love theatre. I had a passion for theatre, I might add. And I remember my friend was home from university. It was like an Easter time, an Easter break. And I thought, I'm going to go see Neil. And as I was sort of turning the car, there was something inside of me said, you wanker, go for it. And I turned the wheel. And I headed there and I met an amazing man called Krishna Dandekar. And the theatre, in the days when regional theatre had subsidy both locally and nationally, this was quite a vibrant small theatre. And this amazing man called Krishna Dandekar saw something. And I think at the time the Arts Council were trying to improve sort of marketing and whatever. And here I am, a person who understood a little bit about marketing and had a passion for newspapers. And he took a chance and gave me a job. And I started on April the 1st, 1978, as a kid. And I had, I forget what it was, at £2,000. I had a £50 dress allowance. And Charles Savage, who's the artistic director now, you know, a significant sort of a man in theatre, just did one thing. They took a risk. And those four letters, the most important letters, risk, because all through my career, it's about clients, about me taking risks. And we're not in the age of taking risks now, to be quite honest. It's a different age. But he took a risk on me. And from that moment, I discovered something that was quite extraordinary, that I could come up with crazy ideas to get bums on seats. And there was a moment where they loved me. The Swindon Evening Advertiser and all this, they loved me because I would sort of play with the media. And people would come in with these week-long runs. And I think we had a production of What No Pyjamas or something with Fiona Fullerton, who was a sort of Bond girl and a sort of risque model. And there was a sort of weird sort of, by today's standards, nothing. But it was a sort of page 3S sort of poster. And I used to slap posters up, and that was part of my job, getting the posters around, sort of fly posting and stuff like that. And it was a weird thing. And then I came to it and they said, well, the poster's gone. They've disappeared. They've all been torn down. That's a bit weird. So I put them up again, and same thing happened again. So just as I was leaving that day, there was a woman in tweeds who was in front of me. And she looked at me and she pointed a finger, pornographer, pornographer. And she left. And I subsequently found this woman was the organiser of the Marlborough and Swindon Bridge Club, who hired that. Next thing, I get a call from the local police station. They went to the box office and said, could I come down? And I said, yes. And I went to Swindon Police Station, met this boy. Oh, yes, Sergeant, Detective Sergeant Barnes will see you. And this very nice sort of thing. Oh, what's going on here? And he said, we've had a complaint for a Mrs. whatever her name was.
I Mrs. Said, Bridge Club.
For distributing pornographic literature. And I said, what? And he said, yes. And he brought this sort of still damp with wallpaper paste poster on it of this rather inane poster.
Presumably Miss Fullerton was clothed.
Clothed, you know.
It was suggestive, but
it was
not
suggestive.
Indecent.
No, of course not. And I said, officer, this isn't pornography. He said, I know. I said, what are you going to do about it? He said, well, I was just think that me and the lads would like 30 tickets. Could we get a discount for a road? And I said, yes, I can give a discount. And I said, but can I tell local press? And in those days when police were more open, he said, yes, I had front page.
Oh, you're post Leveson.
And it was sort of Bobby's. It was front page. You know, Bobby's come to see Saucy Show and the whole report. And I remember I was doing front of SGU.
Did Fiona meet them as well? That would have been a great second.
She didn't. But Fiona. And I remember that night I was doing front of house duty, you know, opening up theatre and making sure, you know, managing the usherettes and whatever. And I saw these two people, and they were clearly not theatre goers. And I could imagine that, and they sat there and they thoroughly enjoyed the show. They loved it. And they came out and I spoke to them and said, oh, we only came because we saw it in the advertiser.
Power of PR.
And I thought, that's what you do.
That's the light bulb moment.
You have that moment. You know, that was my secondary moment. And I came to London. That was it. I mean,
Come to London to seek fame and fortune?
Well, another man who is incredibly powerful for me, who made my career, was a guy called Philip Headley, Theatre Royal Stratford East in the 1980s. It was the most radical theatre at the time, doing incredible work. It lost its grant. He gave me a chance. He'd seen what I'd done and he wanted to do it. And that was history that we were up against cuts, the Arts Council cuts. This is a theatre that was way ahead of diversity and inclusion. We were doing, you know, my first freelance job was for the Black Theatre Cooperative, you know, Trevor Rohn, Michael Abensetz, Tony Marchant, incredible drama. Political theatre at its best at a time, and that was it. And then Philip gave me that chance, and we were fighting to keep the building open when the Arts Council cut its grant. Tony Banks at the time was very supportive. Incredible time of people who've gone on to write incredible TV and stars, you know, like Brenda Blethyn had been there and whatever. And we were a family, and that's when I got connected to the family. The theatre, Mother Theatre and its family, was powerful for me, and some powerful friends. And I stayed there for 4 years developing it and, you know, getting it. Then I got my first West End show, you start to freelance, and then built the agency up, and the rest is history, really, in a sense that understanding about bums on seats and about sustaining a message, that's what it's about. You see everything now and it's quickly gone. Sometimes crisis, sometimes stories, sometimes vegan sausage rolls, or sometimes someone's floated something on the Thames for a stunt. It's about sustaining. And when you've got no money to spend on advertising, on marketing, you need the power of the media, you need the power of influencers and word of mouth, which I built up, and you sustain a message. And that's what I've always tried to do, is to say that every day is a hard. You have got to come up with a creative solution every day. You cannot, and I say to my people every day, you've got to come up with a solution. You've got to create magic for your clients. And if you're not doing that, and I think this is why PR has got very introverted and very trade media focused, very awards focused, which is fine. You know, I've gone for it. I've won awards in the past. I'm not knocking people who do that, but we just lost it. We've just become slightly preening and self-important. Because his clients are important, and sustaining that work, and it's tough. It's tough now, and it was tough in those days because, my business card. You say PR scum are human too, because
I've got your business card.
Yeah, because journalists would attack you, you know, and I look at things now in terms of the sort of millennial culture, generation, whatever culture, and it's all very nice and it's good. I think they're a caring generation coming through who are obsessed, rightly, by the state of affairs at the moment, both environmentally and politically and socially. And but in those days, you were absolutely toasted alive. You were crucified. If they wanted to kill your client, they would kill your client for no good reason. And that was a very hard lesson to learn, taking on some of the real, you know, Rottweilers of tabloid journalism back in the time. And it was fun and it was difficult. And there was bullying and there was aggression, there was dirty tactics and there was hacking. But that was what we got on with. And actually what I loved was the fact that come up with a solution for it. Come up for another way. Pull the rug away from it. You know, don't go bleating to whatever. But it's... You know, I've seen different iterations of the media through the years. I'm pleased about that, and I'm thrilled, and I cherish that. But I have so much more energy now than I've ever had before, because it's an incredible time, as each generation is. I don't sit back. You know, particularly things like the Edinburgh Festival. I got all my lot going to Edinburgh. Talked about the Edinburgh Festival in August. Now, my entertainment team at the moment getting set for Edinburgh. I think, God, and I see some boring old gits. Oh well, Edinburgh's not what it used to be. No, it's not, and that's good. It's not, because it's up to, it's a generation now to invent what it is within media, within whatever. It's not for people to sit back and think, oh, I can remember. You know, there was a lot of drunks. I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of people, a lot of contacts I've had, you know, ended up wasted and dead because of the process. You know, this whole idea that we all went down, which is true. You know, you had long lunches and it was a very...
Got rat-assed.
It wasn't good. Yeah, that wasn't good. It wasn't good for anybody's health. And none of the sort of libations are particularly healthy. And a lot of people were crushed by it. You know, and a lot of women, you know, a lot of strong women came out of it. A lot of women were destroyed by it. A lot of men were destroyed by it. It was a brutal existence because, you know, you were handling, you got that phone call on a Friday night for your client, and it looked pretty bad. And even if it was a nuanced story or story wasn't true, and it still happens to this day, you know, once someone believes that that story is true, because that's the age we're in now, it's a post-truth age. I mean, how ironic, we've had April Fool's Day. What's the point of April Fool's Day? Every day is bloody April Fool's Day.
Right.
You know, it's what the crowd feel. And when you see, when you're inside next to somebody who's got a significant crisis, the people getting at them for clickbait or stories, they don't care. They don't care what they feel about destroying families or whatever, and it's meat. And nor does the audience care, ultimately. The audience want the stories. Our life is one big game show at the moment.
The spectacle itself.
It's always been, you know, the great publicists, when I got obsessed about... I think it was around about the sort of, you know, sort of, there was a sort of moment when there was various relationships being faked, I think at the time, allegedly, you know, Jerry Halliwell and Chris Evans and all these sort of things being built up, you know, for PR purposes. And it was sort of heralded as something that was particularly new and whatever, and reality shows kicked off. And there was all this obsession about throwing out these ne'er-do-wells into society. And I used to say, oh, this is all new. And I said, no, it's not. Because if you're a student of the game, if you actually look back at the game, nothing changes. We are all driven by that curiosity to get inside that titillating story. And great publicists, whether it was the great P.T. Barnum or Harry Reichenbach or whoever, Harry, you know, they knew how to activate the crowd. And some of the darkest publicists, in my estimation, or propaganda merchants, people like Joseph Goebbels, you know. I mean, nothing has changed. The crowd is now leaderless. If you look at the chaos in Brexit now, it's because we have no leaders. Mm. We have no response. You know, the problem of Brexit, both Remain and Stay. So the Remain campaign and the Brexit campaign were appalling campaigns.
Completely agree.
So
with you.
This is a mess we're in now because of vested interests. You can see what's going on in Parliament now. Everybody's got an eye on the next job, keeping their seat in an election. You know, Corbyn stirring up the ERG group. It's all, you know, people are looking at it and saying, hang on a minute, what's about us? And nobody is finding a way of communicating something that is that could have saved this sort of issue. And it's down to backs of sort of lies and fear factor and whatever. And the European Union got a lot to answer for, because who's ever projected the value of the European Union? So this is where PR absolutely fails, because you have process. And what I see now, particularly when you get higher up the food chain, you know, people buy process, they don't buy results. They buy, you know, fancy process that quantifies that sort of job. The success of a campaign is whether you're in a pub and the person in the pub you don't know, and they ask you what you do, and you say, do publicity, and they don't actually know what that is, and you explain it. I've heard about that. I know about that. Or they're talking about your campaign. Or they're talking about campaigns that matter. And you don't hear that because things dissipate so quickly. And never before have I seen such an explosion of new businesses, which is good. Everything is now moving to sort of micro and niche. The big operators, the Edelmans of the world, you know, are still stronger than ever. There's a very interesting sort of, you know, powerful base within that. But the sort of everything is becoming localized and micro. And people from outside this country, we're in a bit of a bubble at the moment, and I don't think we consciously understand how the world see us. They think this country is image, is the royal family, is the Olympics, which was, you know, 8 years ago, nearly 7 years ago. We're still living off that at the moment, which is a great exercise on projecting something, but it was projecting heritage shit. You know, Danny Boyle's opening ceremony was a mark of genius. But, you know, and it sustained lots of things. So you can see powerful communication events, pseudo events that really make an impact. But come on, guys, let's get real about what the world is now and what the challenges we feel in the world. I'm really, really impressed with Extinction Rebellion's work at the moment. Bunch of activists, I know those guys quite well, and I think they're gradually, you know, nudging us towards realization, or, you know, into what we've got to face. And I think that there's a huge amount of too much patting each other on the back, other PR people patting other people, other That's advertising
I
people.
I don't
people
like reading PR Week for that reason, because everyone just congratulating each other.
Well, it is self-congratulating. It is important for people to be in it, and it is important if you're setting up a company. I see, completely see the value of it, and I completely see why it's important. There's all trade publications. Everybody moans about a trade publication. I don't care what it is, whether it's Variety or The Stage or the Mechanical Engineers Gazette. Everybody moans about it if they're not in, and takes it for granted when they're not in. That's when they are in. That's not the point. But the point is actually it's words and deeds and actions are three different things. And I think there needs to be more actions rather than people positioning. Ever has it been thus? So, you know, nothing, you know, my main motto, my main thing, I tell all my people, everything's different, everything's the same.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Do you think that breakdown in trust, though, this lack of leadership that we have in Western society, is an opportunity for PR people like us? Or is it actually that, you know, the rise of Trump and people like Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, where they feel that it's actually a backlash against this over-polished type presentation? Like people like Tony Blair and Barack Obama, they say, oh, they're too polished. Every single comma and every single word is perfect. And they're like, you know, so-called quote-unquote real people. People like, you know, Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, whether they're right or wrong politically.
Real people or not. Yeah.
Well, normal people feel an actual genuine connection with them.
I think it's complex. I think it's incredibly complex. I think we have the hindsight of looking back at things with 2020 vision, and there's always a myriad of arguments that actually shape things. I think the problem is the media are looking for the soundbite now. He who can conjure the best soundbite wins. And we do not have the capacity in this digitally, with our minds like goldfish spinning around, to actually hover on something and really digest it. We've lost, and the generation do not want to read long form. And how many websites now throw up, this is a minute read, this is a 4 minute read, this is a 10 minute read. I mean, it's interesting, I think, where the New Yorker and New York Times have sort of exploded and actually doing more. I think the Times is a very good paper at the moment. Guardian is trying as well. But irrespective, everybody's trying to come up with
bite-sized.
Yeah, they're trying to come up with an easy answer for what is a very... I think it is certainly television and the video previous to that, the image, whether it was Kennedy or whatever, the mark of elections were won by the force of personality that the people bought into. And look what's happening in Eastern Europe now. This sort of this comedian or this show host is going to win the presidential sort of thing. But he is. I think people just are familiar with people. And all those people who you mentioned, from Boris Johnson to Farage or Trump, are showmen. They're absolutely showmen. And history will tell us that showman wins. Showmen actually are somebody who go out there.
P.T. Barnum, all over again.
Yeah, it's just a didactic or whatever. It's very difficult for us to sort of buy into that sort of that person. And I think I remember sort of in the old days that, you know, you wouldn't get a celebrity in a broadsheet. And I remember the Telegraph running, you know, something on, I think it was either Vanessa May, and it was a photogenic moment, she was on the front page. And I thought, my God, the Telegraph were putting some facile story. And I thought something has changed then, because this is a drive for readership, for clicks, for advertising, for likes and whatever. And I think people have become a lot more pragmatic about the news. This is, you know, James Harding's new thing, Tortoise, is a very interesting concept that he's doing with Katie Vanek at the moment. I think it's a really interesting concept of slow news, slow digestion. But we've got education is also in a problem now, you know, in terms of how we're training people to get to university through exam. We're not in a process of teaching people or learning. I mean, I was lucky to have some really great teachers who mentored me and brought my interests alive. I mean, I've got a friend who's a teacher who's actually buying his own calculators for his class because the teacher ran out of money. There's a school in Bristol who's down to 3.5 4.5 days a week at the moment because they can't afford to open 4 days. I mean, these are important things, and these are things that are overshadowing the Brexit. And this is what annoys me about Brexit, is actually taking us out of really important issues the last 2 years, because we're focusing on a bunch of braying people, you know, trying to, you know, sell us the idea that, you know, come tomorrow we'll be drinking Watney's Red Barrel and watching, you know, sort of black and white movies on a Sunday afternoon, you know, and playing golf, you know, it's so complex. So therefore, when you've got these powerful communicators who just understand soundbite, they are bewitching and they're dragging people because they're saying things. Donald Trump does not build anything he says up on any factual thing. And I would be very surprised to see Donald Trump not being a second term president, you know, no matter what it is. And if we've got analytics where you see noise generating around certain things we analyze for our clients, you know, it's coastal in America. You know, you can see these flare-ups and these heat maps. It's very coastal. It's East Coast, West Coast, you know, obviously Washington and whatever. But the rest of the place is dark. You know, no one's clicking into this. And I think we can be very hubristic. We have a media bubble in London, which I benefit from. But we're not interested in what's happening in Sunderland or Swansea or whatever. And despite what Channel 4, you know, position themselves, we're going out to the regions now, moving out of London and stuff like this. This is all virtue signalling. And I just think that Brexit and Trump as a group of the media losing touch with what people had actually sort of fed on. And there's some very clever people. And, you know, and I look at the people that talked about, and there are so many interesting people way below the waterline that are affecting our life, who are not sought out, who are not got at. How long did it take to get to Cambridge Analytica, you know, and what, you know, Nigel Oakes had been doing before Cambridge Analytica was way back in the 80s. You know, using data, using basics to actually inform opinion, and we look at the celebrity, the easy clickbait angle, without actually reporting the hard stuff, and there isn't the resources really to do things in the way. And I think the newspapers, particularly the broadsheets, lost confidence in themselves around the 90s. And, you know, the Modern Review was very significant with what Toby Young and Julie Birchall did in popularising sort of culture, making it feel a little bit more intellectual. But, you know, I look at things, and today there was the most ridiculous headline that was in the Daily Mail about the English National Opera, which I know something about, for the crisis they've been through. And the new director, Stuart Murphy, who comes from TV, an interesting appointment, you know, said, we're going to drag in audiences, new audiences, to the E&O for opera work. So we're going to invite the likes of Holly Willoughby and Davina McCall to tweet about the performance. And this is going to attract a young audience. What a pile of rubbish. You know
they're chasing the physical equivalent of clicks, i.e. footfall.
But it's celebrity again. Yeah. I'm, God bless, you know, Holly and Davina, you know, whether they want to spend 6 hours sitting through the Meister Singers, it's neither here nor there. But what planet are these people on? And again, it's a headline, it's a celebrity, and it's a clickbait. And no one is thinking about how do you get the difficult questions, why do you get the difficult ideas through, you know, a media that are under-resourced, are lazy, looking for headlines, looking for immediacy, looking for exclusives, looking to get ahead of the Twitter trends. You know, how do you do that when everybody now has got a voice, or supposedly's got a voice? Some say, oh, well, it's big on Twitter. And I said, what? You know, 13 people have got 10 followers are saying this is a big idea. You know, these are screwed metrics. And the biggest part of our industry at the moment is everybody selling you evaluation tools, selling you ways of sort of automating sort of content or whatever. You know, it's distracting because, you know, it takes time to develop a story. It takes time to build influence around it. And whether or not Piers Morgan or whoever sort of jumps up and down on it, you know, they're doing it for their own. You know, I like Piers.
He's playing Piers Morgan.
And that he's building himself into, you know, Piers Morgan could stand.
He could become a politician.
So you're asking that question.
He's got 8 million followers on Twitter. He's a character.
But, you know, when you see some of the decisions newspapers have made for senior positions over the years, you know, that's slightly dumbing down the process. This is just an observation. There's pragmatic commercial decisions being made around these things. But, you know, everybody should take a very good look at themselves at the state we're in at the moment and the confusion we face and say, actually, be careful what you wish for.
Are we complicit in it? We as in the audience, the viewers, the listeners, the readers.
Of course we're complicit in it. I mean, if people didn't want to know about the sort of the goings on of a celebrity in the heyday of the News of the World, simply don't buy the News of the World. I mean, they don't have to. It's called choice. When people talk to me about, advertising and PR is, you know, so aggressive, it's choice. You know, what we're doing, should be offering people choice. And everybody's been fascinated. This is not a modern thing. You know, at the height of the silent movie era, there were magazines selling people's, you know, lifestyles. Nothing changes. We're fascinated by that. So, of course, we're complicit, but we've lost the ability to find true critical opinion that is beyond just blathering some soundbite on Twitter and thinking that's a genius. Because Twitter is genius. You know, there are often fantastic people on it. I noticed something yesterday about Jamila Jahal saying that, you know, she's, you know, feisty. Yeah, of course she's feisty. It's very good. It's very easy to, you know, to troll people. It's very easy to be unkind to people. It's very, you know, people don't think of the effects because they've got this voice. It's a sort of outside themselves, they're fueling, you know, and the greatest threats to us are the likes of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And I think it's highly ironic that Prince Harry barks out yesterday that how gaming and social media is awful 2 days after they announced
their Instagram
feed. I mean, are they insane? But of course, they're not insane because they
clearly didn't have a messaging grid.
Yeah, that, I love that one. But it's 2 days after, you know, because we are like goldfish. We're spinning around the bowl. What's next? What's next? What's next? Nothing, you know, is remembered in the way that it used to be and would actually sustain people. And that's sometimes good because people make mistakes. People are making mistakes. And people should be allowed to recover from those mistakes. They should not be allowed to repeat those mistakes, but at least they should be able to recover and given a second chance. There's no second chances now for a lot of people.
Game over.
Yeah, and particularly, you know, if you're pale, male and stale, mate, it's history.
And how have things changed in the job recently in terms of dealing with crises? Because it's so easy now to destroy someone's reputation or a brand's reputation with a rogue tweet or something in error. I mean, Churchill, I think, said the problem with the world is a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth has even got its boots on. I mean, now you can tweet something and within sort of 20 minutes, your career can be over.
I think it's true. Your career potentially could be over. Do you know what? It was harder back then to protect people. It was much harder because it felt sometimes you were fighting a battle. What's interesting now is if there is a half-truth, there is a piece of fake news, there is a bit of nuancing going on, if your client has got a big enough channel or he has the ability to position his argument from his own lips or from her own lips, then that can go viral and that can undo quite a lot. I think it's always about moving quickly. It's never changed that. It's always about having the best you can in terms of trusted relationships to build that up. I think a lot of people who are doing crisis now, who are very good at their trade, have been around the block for a long time. And even in Hollywood, you know, certainly up to 5 or 6 years ago, most of the people wrangling significant reputations were north of 40 and had seen it all. And those sort of people are you know what it takes. I think that now we have more mechanisms to counter. We have better relationships with legal firms, which I think a certain part of me dies if I have to commission a legal firm there to start writing.
I find more often than not now it's the legal firms that are commissioning us.
Yeah, a bit. Yeah, this is a dual thing. You know, IPSA doesn't work. You know, I mean, it's just useless. Of course, what you find now is that a story will be tried out on a digital platform. And it can be quickly taken down if someone cries foul. So I think it's the technology that has always changed things. The thing about PR folk is that they've always grabbed technology right at the top of it, whether it was using telegrams, whether it was using faxes, whether it was using mail merge, whatever the technology came, the first people to jump on that were communicators, PR people. And I think we were the first to actually see the advantage of social media, sometimes before our clients, because it could become a significant medium to stay a story. So what doesn't change is the human reaction to it. And people say to me, look, my kid wants to get into, wants to do PR or media or whatever. What course should he study? Should he go to Bournemouth in Westminster? And I say, do anthropology. Understand human behaviour. The great publicists understood the crowd, understood the herd, understood what motivated people. And the great political spin masters understood that. So I think things have changed is that things can evaporate very quickly. I think that you have the ability of reforming a story very quickly if it's untrue. If you can create a creative narrative, a counter narrative to it, that can help things. It helps if your client has huge confidence in himself or herself in what they do. And I think, I've always said people get the PR they deserve. Because some people, find it very difficult to communicate. I think there's been some great politicians who should have got into power, who might have changed things for us, who just weren't fit for the media age. And now we are looking at personality before the substance of what people are saying. And repeating myself slightly, how people feel about those people in front of you.
But isn't the choice of whether you have a leader ultimately an emotional one? Because the public can't have metrics on whether Boris Johnson, can type at a certain rate of words per minute or whether he's got the right connections. It's all effectively subjective, is it not?
I think people, to a certain extent, were better informed.
I mean, Theresa May seems to be reasonably competent, but she's clearly socially and or media.
That's an interesting statement to put. I mean, clearly Theresa May has a sense of duty and purpose within it. Yeah, it's impossible. It's like it's trying to get to the moon on a tandem, really, with Jezza on the back. I mean, I think that we become a lot more partisan. We become a lot more tribal. We become a lot more niche. We've got a lot more, we're stuck in whatever bubble we're in. And breaking out of that bubble is very difficult when you're served stuff that you need. And I think there should be a lot more critical appraisal of the systems that we use for ease. There's not a free lunch. You use Facebook or you use Twitter or whatever you use to express your views or can get your news. If it's free, what's the price? What are you giving away? And I think people are waking up to that to a certain extent after what happened to Cambridge Analytica. But, these things are multi-leveled. And I think that one has to, we don't have the ability to sit back. And I used to encourage my folk to gaze out the window. And somebody said to me, they're wasting hours. And I said, well, actually, reflection is incredibly important for a creative process. You don't come up with an idea. You work as a team. I've been lucky to have, many incredible people working for me in all different levels. Some people call it a cult. I'm deeply, deeply proud of people who've gone on to set up their own companies or who've gone on to, represent brands and whatever. And I've got a great set of young people. And at the moment, I'm pretty lucky to attract great people because it's not about me, it's about all those sort of people doing the hard work. But you have to create that environment. And one of the things is actually creating a reflective environment for people to think about what they're doing and to be sensible about it, rather than making dumb decisions because a bunch of sort of cool kids in Shoreditch are telling them that, you know. It's actually having the strength of your personality, you know, to really be positive about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and having a real goal, and attracting the sort of clients that will allow you to do that. Because sometimes we've all done it, you know, you chase the money, and sometimes you're chasing a very big fee, a very difficult job. That's the ones that actually test your credibility, that test your morals, and everybody will have those challenges. And that can pivot and change the way corporate culture works within an organisation.
Well, look at Bell Pottinger.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very complex story. And I think we've seen the top level of it. I think it's very deep. I looked at that story, and of course, the entire virtue signaling PR profession sort of leapt on it. Mm. I think it stemmed from a situation where they had been involved with, a bit of a downturn in fees, down to an expose the Independent did, catching them with a fake lobbying job that exposed some of the things. So, you know,
the PRCA wanted to be seen to hold them, but like, well, make an example
to,
of them.
You know, one of their competitors, a couple of their competitors, and one in particular said to me, "Why would I want to be part of an organisation that's going to fire me?" So, and I thought, well, that's interesting. So you think that, yes, the PRCA do some great work in training people and bringing people together and helping people and creating rules and giving people indication, particularly if you're a growing company, and they used to have some very, you know, start metrics to join. So as a trade body, I know how hard they work. But at the end of the day, sometimes it reflects an insular world. And I always think that, you know, how many of the really interesting PR companies, I use that word in inverted commas, are not members of PRCA?
I resigned about 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, I'm still in there.
Are PR people born, like, with that talent? Is it innate, or is it something you can learn? You know, I spoke to a friend of mine, a senior PR guy, a few years ago, and he said you're either a natural communicator or you're not. And he said it's like the clap, you've either got it or you haven't.
Yeah, the old Hollywood publicists used to call it the stuff. People had the stuff. Your clients had the stuff, you had the stuff. Listen, you asked about changes. A lot of changes now is the fact that, and some of my old mates in PR moan about this. Oh, why don't people go out? Why don't people lunch? These young people kick them out. Actually, they don't want to do that. They don't want to do that, and that's fine. They communicate through other means to talk to people. And if you're working in a digital platform, which is more or less a battery hen farm, where you don't see the light of day and there's no clocks there, you don't have any time to... And it's a different way of networking now. I personally don't think it's the best way of networking,
to eyeball someone.
You just need to meet people, you need to understand people and get people out. But you just don't have the time, you know, to get out there. You can't put, you know, press junkets together like you used to do, you know, over 2 or 3 days going to some exotic place to, you know, to meet your client. So it's sort of different. So are people born? Yeah, in any profession, you're good, you know. I mean, you know, there are certain people born to be an undertaker. There's certain people born to be an accountant. There's certain people born to be a golf pro, you know, born to be an entrepreneur. I think you just have to be lucky enough to understand or get that opportunity to be that sort of person. And the problem now, everybody sees, you know, PR as something that is achievable and sexy and whatever. And everything is changing, you know, PRs and, you know, will be redundant. You know, in 10 or 15 years, we'll have AI versions of ourselves communicating messages. I mean, the work that's going on in AI is quite staggering, you know, in terms of that. But I mean, ultimately, there is a point where human contact is important. And if you can't communicate, if you're an introvert, then the art of PR is not for you. But then again, you might have a different skill. I was thinking with any company, you're not going to win. You're not going to win the Open with a putter. And every company needs a skill set of people. You can't have a bunch of, you know, leaders out there, you've got to have the support staff, you've got to have people underneath that. And I was very keen to create a structure where everybody had a voice. You know, some of the best ideas used to come from the person on the reception.
Yeah.
You know, I remember that adage about the cleaners at NASA. Cleaners at NASA put a man on the moon. It's true. And from that man who gave him a first break, you know, Krishna Dandekar was obsessed about the cleanliness of the theatre. He doesn't want someone going in and actually sitting down and actually finding they're sitting in someone's sort of chewing gum they've left on the seat, you know, because that's the experience you have. So I think it's a holistic thing you look at, and you look for people with differing strengths, differing personalities to make up what is a family or a cult to actually do the best. And that's
a family or a cult.
Yeah, like that. And that's a difficult thing, you know, because you never get a perfect signal.
But when you're interviewing people, because you're like me, you're in the hiring and firing game. Do you kind of use your experience and your gut to kind of make an assessment of someone? Sort of the first 30 seconds, you think, yeah, this person's got it, or they haven't, or is that unfair?
If someone impresses me in the first 30 seconds, I don't employ them. Do you know what?
That means I've got a chance then.
Well, no, because PR people, whatever their skill set, are pretty good at selling themselves.
Mm.
So it's impossible. So I never meet anybody first round. I have a brilliant HR woman, Angela, who keeps in line, and I have other people in the company go through that, and then I meet them. And yes, at some point at the interview, I've got to think, you know, can I go on a long train journey to Hull with this person?
Mm.
And, you know...
And the second question is, why would you ever go to Hull, of course? But that's a separate
know,
question.
Listen, hang on. Hull was City of Culture, I mean, right? You know, listen, you're a man from that part of the world.
Yeah, indeed.
You should... You know, let's not be regionalist here, Paul. The thing is that, you know, you're looking for people with ambition and passion. You're looking for people who will not, you know. I used to kick people out of my office. I had a bunch of people who worked on the Sony account, and they wouldn't leave the office. You know, they love that client so much. They love the work. And that's the cruel thing is that, you know, when you've worked so passionately for... Well, we had Vodafone for 7 years. We launched Vodafone. I remember one of our jobs was getting people to use text messaging, you know. And it's a hell of a thing to lose a huge client like that. Not just, you know, financially, which was a bit of a blow, but for the team.
It's emotional.
Worked so hard. And, you know, I was with one of my old people over lunch yesterday. He's got a very neat new PR company, which is going places. And, you know, he was talking about and all the teething pains and growing pains and the client relationship issues he has is no different from anybody else, I tell him. You know, everybody feels that. And, you know, you just have to find a way of navigating through and having the room and the ability to make the right choices about your clients, because pitching is grovelling shamelessly for work. It's a complete stitch-up. It's never ultimately about the work you are going to do for them. Usually the pitch, you never, ever do the work you say at a pitch you can do for them. It changes. It's whether those people across the room like you.
Mm.
And that's sort of irrational, really, because, you know, you can have a lot of likability and have no... ability, and secondly, you can keep a client going because you're pretty damn good at process. And before they know it, you think, we spent what on what? You know, and...
It's difficult, though, because is it a skill to pick up the phone a seventh time when six journalists have already turned you down? I'd say it's more of a character trait
If you're saying the same thing to a journalist on your six phone calls and getting a six reaction, you're doing something wrong. So
now, this is why I could never work for you. You fire me within a week.
You know, in conversation with a journalist, you've got to A, know the journalist and what turns them on. You've got to A, know what the journalist writes about, what they're interested in. And you've got to have something that is something that's news. You know, when you're talking, if you're talking to news or a make, there's got to be something that's relevant within it. Not that I exist, therefore I'm looking, you know, that I exist, therefore I'm looking for publicity. And it's a lot of people come in and say, well, I've done this. And I say, what's interesting about thousands of people are doing that. And you stop, well, I remember something coming in and I said, well, I've seen two other people in your space. Well, there's nobody else in my space as good as me. And I said, well, actually they are. And here's a piece, you know, on a website that actually shows what they're doing in your space. And people are just hubristic. So that's sometimes difficult. I mean, talking talking truth to clients is the toughest thing, particularly at crisis. Mm. And I've got a very difficult week ahead of me next week, you know, dealing with someone who cannot accept what's happening to him. He's just got to get with the times. So you do become part shrink. You know, particularly when you're dealing with that, you've got to reach people. But you know, there's people don't fire clients enough, and I think that I've done it a couple of times. I've not done it enough.
I did it once last week, but I haven't done it for about 3 years before that, and it was quite stressful actually.
Well, you've got to feel guilty.
You've got to think
of a team of 7 people, possibly 5 people, 3 people, or whatever the team working on the job, and you've got to think about what does that say to them, because you're making a decision. Your instinct, your knowledge of what's coming down the pipe is not what they are, and they don't understand that.
So actually, it motivated my team that worked on this client because they weren't a pleasure to work for. Really, in fact, it was demoralising.
Yeah, well, then that's you can't do that. And I think you ask what different now. People are expecting a lot more from the workspace. There's a lot more that they're not buying into the fact that they are going to possibly work for you. Loyalty is not at a premium as such, although I've been blessed. I must say I've been blessed by people who have been incredibly loyal to me, and and I sometimes regret I don't keep up with them as I should, you know, because I've got a life. But you know, I've
had people that have worked for me for 2 or 3 years, and then we've parted amicably, and I think, well, that was a good period of time for them to work for me, and it was time for them to move on.
True, and I think that's the case. But I think people don't come in with that sort of sensation. It's very much, you know, listen, it's an incredibly personal experience that you go through with people, and you've got to create structure. You've got to create a structure to allow people to develop. They've got to be learning. I always thought I did my best. I'm not sure I changed it all the time, to create a learning environment where I could bestow some of my experience on people, whether it was wisdom or not, I don't know, but give them some idea of the way it goes. And because it's whether it's a blogger, an influencer, a journalist, you know, a client or whatever, you've got to understand human emotion. You've got to understand what makes that human tick, you know. And sometimes if you manage to make contact with somebody who's important and they've had a bad day, don't take it personally.
Now, when you went through your career at the beginning, you said, you know, you'd started with your first West End show, and then you said you went freelance and then started an agency, and the rest is history. And I loved how you summarised that 30 years in 20 seconds there. Do you have an ideal amount of people, like the size for your agency, for a Borkowski agency? Because I've done this. I've been in the same game as you for 15 years. And, you know, sometimes we've been 30, sometimes we've been 5, and I'm still trying to get the levers in the right order. At the moment, we're around 20, and that seems to be about the right size for me. When I've gone bigger than that, it's always gone wrong.
It just depends on what you want to achieve. I think that if you want to remain a boutique business, there are some fantastic arts consultancies that started up when I was going. There's still 4 or 5 people and do incredibly well, have great influence, and make you know, good money, I would assume. There are growing agencies that want to own the world. You want to sort of have offices in every country in the world. I think it is what your business plan is, where you want to be, how you see yourself going, where do you want to be in 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years, and marking that. And at the heart of it, you've got to have a real strident financial backbone. You have to have, a structure of people around you, a good board, to make that work. And, you know, sometimes that's worked for me, sometimes it hasn't. And it's what your dimension is. I mean, for me, how I thought my business would be in 89 is not how it was in 95, how it wasn't in 2005, how it certainly wasn't in 2009, and how it wasn't now to this day. So opportunities...
No battle plan ever survives contact with the enemy. I think Hannibal. Or is it misattributed to him?
Yeah. I retraced Hannibal's steps with 3 elephants and Ian Botham back in 1989. That was an experience. So I got to know Hannibal's footsteps really quite well.
Well, actually, that brings me on to my next question, because, I mean, you are the master of the publicity stunt. Coming up with some genius things like, you know, gift wrapping a helicopter to publicise Harrods. And I think, didn't you once fill Selfridges with about 700 naked people?
Expensive tunic.
I noticed she didn't call me for that.
That was the most bizarre day of my life. It was a Sunday, and there's me and Patsy, who was working on the account for Selfridges at the time, and I think James Bidwell, and we were the only three clothed people in the entire store. But there's a classic example of old Selfridge.
We'll use that as a pull quote, by the way.
Yeah, Peter Williams, Beb Churchill, James Bidwell. They were an incredible team of people who went on to sell with these huge events that we contributed to, you know. And I think, yeah, I've lost track on some of the more wild and wonderful things I did. And of
Is
course,
that where you get the most enjoyment, though? Are you kind of stunt-oriented?
I don't know. Listen, I think it's a very dangerous world for some of the stunts I've pulled off. You know, I've been nearly arrested. I've nearly killed myself. I've nearly killed clients. I've seen clients be fired. You know, that word risk, you know, you have to do in a stunt, you know, for it to go around the globe. And, of course, you know, it's different now because you can't really be part of, you know, the sort of fake news twirl. And I think very few. I remember I looked at for Typhoo, one of the stunts I wanted to pull off was take the Hollywood sign. And this is before Photoshop. So I employed a crack team of ex-military people. And we spent 2 weeks looking what it would be for one moment to take off to the two. It was a two O's in Hollywood and turn it into Typhoo. And we could have done it, and it was quite affordable to do, and we looked into it, and it was sort of post 9/11, so there was it. Anyway, we had a meeting with the client, and the client said, so what's the negativity side of this? And the client said, well, my guys probably would have to have bulletproof vests because there's a good opportunity they'd be shot. Yeah. And the client looked at me.
And spent like 20 years in a Supermax.
And I remember saying, it's a great opportunity, Bill. Why don't we go for it? But those have come from great clients. I've got a great client now, Bill Muirhead, who's an advertising man, who is Agent General of South Australia. I've had him for 15 years. He loves a great, he likes a great, great sort of bit of creativity. I remember wrapping a house. I mean, that was incredible. I wrapped an entire house to give away for a Valentine's Day present. And it went right the way around the world. Santa, also a little kid who said, was buying a house, said, will Santa get down my chimney? And we actually worked on a Santa perfect chimney, the dimensions, what it would take to get Santa down the chimney and putting it up and down and whatever. There's got to be a real sense of narrative running, not some floating something
cobbled together
the,
thing.
Floating something down the Thames. It's got to have at a root of a story that a journalist looks at it and thinks, "Hang on a minute, it ain't right." But do you know what? It's fun.
It's cheeky.
And I think what's changed for me is that I used to be someone who's obsessed by The Basement. The Basement was a final and finally story on the front page of Nationals that would just spark things off. It doesn't exist anymore.
Is that just the risk averse elf and safety culture?
Well, I think rightly so. I mean, some of the stuff I did for the circuses I present in my early career, I mean, you know, no strings and a safety net, you know, doing incredible stunts on tops of buildings or whatever for a photo opportunity and whatever. I mean, God, they were fearless. And our chaos, which was, you know, which is as chainsaw juggling crazy circus that I went on the road with when I was a kid, you know, they were incredible. They didn't care. Is it going to get us publicity? We'll do it. People look at things. I noticed a great stunt yesterday. It was lemur yoga for a hotel in Keswick. And I thought, it's a beautiful stunt. All good looking people doing their yoga poses amongst a bunch of sort of exotic animals for a hotel in Chiswick. They invented lemur. I thought, brilliant. That's just sweet and great. And is there really a thing called lemur yoga? Who cares? It's a great photo. And I think where you push it is where there is a sort of, there's a sort of edge that there's not a sense of fun with it. Publicity stunts come with a bit of fun. I'm very impressed with what Taylor Herring does, James Herring's company now, I think, you know, do some very clever stuff. I think there's a lot of people trying to do it, and we did the corporate work for Beano, and they were doing the consumer work, and they came up with the idea of actually writing a letter to Jacob Rees-Mogg saying, stop nicking the IP of Mr. Softly, and it was it went everywhere because it's clever. I think a lot of people do stunts that get a lot of awards but do nothing, you know, because they just dissipate very quickly. I think it sustains, and there is a formula. There is a formula for a publicity stunt. I own that formula, and I know how it works. I can bet you, if you hit these elements within a format, your stunt will work and it will go global, because that's the point. You've got to go outside this country for it really to be a success. So, I mean, I remember when I had Jim Rose Circus, I let a bunch of scorpions let loose in the BBC green room of Pebble Mill. I mean, that was chaos. That brought the BBC
to you really stop. Ought to be doing 30 to Life, really, shouldn't you?
Oh, instead God, of, I mean, could pontificating. I do that? Could I do that now? I mean, did I check whether... Yeah, I did say to somebody of the stings.
Oh, you're covered then. You're all right.
But I don't know whether they were. And I walked an elephant across a road.
Isn't history written by the victor, though? I mean, the fact that you got away with that and no one was harmed means you're a legend. It could have gone wrong.
A legend, maybe, not a legend. No, definitely not a legend. I mean, I just won in a line of a lot of people who've done some great fun things and had a, you know, can tell a few war stories about it. Oh, look, there's things that went tragically wrong that were terrible ideas. I mean, I had a crap idea once. I thought it was a great idea. And I launched the first Nando's. My idea was that we would do... It's even crazy talking about it. And if Miranda's listening to this, you worked hard on this. But we got helium balloons and we flew pieces of fried chicken all over Ealing. And if you collected this chicken, it was encouraged not to eat it, obviously. But if you collected this, you could go in. It could have been a plastic fake piece of chicken, but no, it had to be a real piece of chicken.
Riddled with Campylobacter.
Weeks later, rats and cats were dying of this. It was a terrible idea.
I disagree. I think it sounds brilliant.
No, it was a crap idea. But I mean, it was, you know, but I had a great client, Robbie, then who set up Nando's, South African, who'd done some aggressive PR stunts in South Africa. He was a great supporter of it, but I didn't keep the account. I wonder why.
What's next for you? Is it more of the same? Will you still be doing this 20 years from now?
Well, it's two things. Either the business will retire me and said I had enough of it, or I can't think of anything else I want to do. You know, I look at a lot of my friends who sold up and did very well, and they went around the world, or they bought their 12 houses or their collectible cars or whatever. And do you know what? Each one of them said, I want to get back into the business, because actually it's a very exciting business to be in. And also, you get a call. I had a call yesterday, and the most extraordinary call. And I don't think a week goes by when I don't hear something. I might not be able to represent it, it might be true, but you hear fantastic things. You see the underbelly, you see something else that's going on. And I would be cut off from that. So if my health gives up, then obviously that's an issue. If my
you mind, seem to be in fine fettle.
My brain doesn't start working. But I don't think... I look at some of the... When I wrote the Fame Form, I had the joy of seeing some of the most powerful people of a generation, many of which died after them. After I came back from... I remember coming back from two trips to LA, and every time I came back, the person I'd interviewed died. So I didn't publicise that. I thought, don't speak to them. You know, and...
You've got a reverse Midas touch.
They still have it. But as long as I still have the capability and as still I can do it, I don't see any reason why I shouldn't do it. The day it becomes like work to me, then it's time to pack it up. But where we'll all be in the next year or 2 years, who knows? I mean, you know, anybody who makes plans, God's laughing at you.
Mark, I know you'll dispute this, but you're a legend. Thanks ever so much for your time. I appreciate it.
I will dispute it. Thank you, Paul, for having me. And it's been a pleasure talking to you.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.